Hebrews 12, verses 18 and 19 from John Owen's commentary on Hebrews. For you are not come unto the mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, or the fire that burned, nor to blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of the trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more. The general scope of the words must first be opened, and then the particular expressions that are contained in them. The principal design in hand is a description of that evangelical state in which the Hebrews were called, which they were come and entered into. For from this the apostle infers his ensuing exhortation. But this their coming he expresses negatively to introduce a description of the church state under the Old Testament and a manner of the people's entrance into it, whence he confirms both his argument and his exhortation. You are not come. And two things are included in that negative expression. One, what their fathers did. They came, as we shall see, to the things here mentioned. And two, what they were delivered from by their call to the gospel. They were no more concerned in all that dread and terror, and the consideration of this deliverance was to be of moment with them, with respect to their perseverance in the faith of the gospel. For this is a fundamental privilege which we receive by this, namely a deliverance from the terror and curse of the law. And we may observe some few general things in this proposal of the way of the people's approach to God at Sinai, before we open the several passages contained in the words, as one, the apostle in this comparison between their coming of old into the legal church state and our admission into the state of the gospel includes a supposition of the way and manner in which they approach to God and the giving of the law. This is by the sanctification of themselves, a washing of their clothes as an outward sign of it, with other reverential preparations, Exodus 19, verses 10 and 11. So it will follow that, the gospel church state being so much more excellent than that of old, God himself being in it in a more glorious and excellent manner, we ought to endeavor a more imminent sanctification and preparation in all our approaches to God in it. And therefore he closes his discourse with an exhortation to this, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, verse 28. This therefore he teaches us in the whole, namely, that the grace, love, and mercy of God in the dispensation of the gospel requires an internal sanctification and due preparation with holy fear and reverence in all our approaches to him and his worship, answerable to the type of it in the people's preparation for the receiving of the law, and a fear that was wrought in them by the terror of God in it. Our fear is of another kind than theirs was, yet ought to be no less real and effectual in us to its proper end. Number two, as to the appearance of the divine majesty here declared, we may observe that all such apparitions were still suited to the subject matter, or what was to be declared of the mind of God in them. So he appeared to Abraham in the shape of a man, Genesis 18, verses 1 and 2, because he came to give the promise of the blessed seed and to give a representation of the future incarnation. In a like shape, he appeared to Jacob in Genesis 32, verse 24, which was also a representation of the Son of God as incarnate, blessing the church. To Moses he appeared as a fire in a bush which was not consumed, Exodus 3, verses 2 to 6, because he would let him know that the fire of affliction in the church should not consume it because of his presence in it. He dwelt in the bush. To Joshua he appeared as an armed man with his horn drawn in his hand, Joshua 5, verse 13, to assure him of victory over all of his enemies. But here he appears encompassed with all the dread and terror described, and this was to represent the holiness and severity of the law with the inevitable and dreadful destruction of sinners who betake not themselves to the promise for relief. Number three, these appearances of God were the glory of the Old Testament, the great fundamental security of the faith of believers, the most eminent privilege of the church. Yet were they all but types and obscure resemblances of that which was granted in the foundation of the gospel church state, and this was that God was manifest in the flesh. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, or the incarnation of the Son of God. For in it the fullness of the Godhead dwelt in him bodily, Colossians 2, verse 9. That is, really and substantially, in which all other appearances were but shadows. And fourth, we may also observe some things in general concerning this appearance of the divine majesty, which intimate the glory and terror of it, as it was on the top of a high mountain, not in a plain. As this had great appearance of the throne of majesty, so it being above the people, as it were over them, it was fit to fill them with dread and fear. They looked up and saw the mountain above them full of fire and smoke, the whole mount quaking greatly, thunders and terrible voices being heard in the air. Exodus 19, verse 18, and 20, verse 18, and Deuteronomy 4, verse 11. They could have no other thoughts on this, but that it was a fearful thing to come to judgment before this holy God. And one view of that terror of the Lord's holiness and severity, which were here represented, is enough to make the stoutest sinner to quake and tremble. Also, to increase the reverence due to this appearance, the people were commanded their distance and straitly forbidden an approach beyond the bounds fixed to them. This prohibition was confirmed with a sanction that everyone who transgressed it should be stoned as detestable and devoted to utter destruction. These things, accompanied with the dreadful spectacles here mentioned by the apostle, did all lead to generate an awful fear and reverence of God in his giving of the law. This is a way in which those under the Old Testament entered into the church state, which begot in them a spirit of bondage and fear during its continuance. That expression, "they came," included in this, "you are not come," comprises all the sacred preparation which by God's direction the people made use of when they approached to the mount, concerning which the reader may see our exhortations in the first volume of this exposition. There are two things in the remaining words. First, what the people so came to, and secondly, what effect it had upon them, especially as to one instance. Two, it was a barren and fruitless desert. Might be touched, the fire that burned, blackness, darkness, tempest, the sound of the trumpet, and the voice of words. The event was that they entreated that the words might be spoken to them no more. First, they came to the mount that might be touched. This mount was Sinai in the wilderness of Horeb, which was in the deserts of Arabia. So our apostle says, Mount Sinai in Arabia, Galatians 4, verse 25. And the apostle mentions this in the first place because with respect to this mountain, all the laws and directions of the people's approach to God were given, Exodus 19. Of this mount it is said it might be touched. The word means to feel, to touch, to handle, Luke 24, verse 39, 1 John 1, verse 1. And it is sometimes applied to any means of attempting the knowledge of what we inquire after, Acts 17, verse 27. And the apostle observes this concerning the mountain, that it might be touched, felt, or handled, that it was a sensible carnal thing exposed to the outward senses, to the most earthly of them, namely feeling, from the prohibition given, that none should touch it. For unless it might have been touched naturally, none could have been morally prohibited to touch it. And he makes this observation for two reasons. One, to manifest how low and inferior the giving of the law was in comparison of the promulgation of the gospel, which was from heaven, as we shall see afterwards, verse 25. It was that which might be touched with the hands of men or by beasts themselves. Number two, to intimate the bondage and fear the people were then in, who might not so much as touch the mountain, where were the signs of God's presence, so it was in itself a thing exposed to the sense of all creatures. And there is much of divine wisdom that manifests itself in the choice of this place for the giving of the law. Four, it was an absolute solitude, a place remote from the habitation and converse of men. Here the people could neither see nor hear anything but God and themselves. There was no appearance of any relief or place of retreat, but there they must abide the will of God. And this teaches us that when God deals with men by the law, he will let them see nothing but himself and their own consciences. He takes them out of their reliefs, reserves, and retreats. For the most part, when the law is preached to sinners, they have innumerable diversions and reliefs at hand to shield themselves from his terror and efficacy. The promises of sin itself are so, and so are the promises of future amendment. So also are all the businesses and occasions of life which they betake themselves to. They have other things to do than to attend to the voice of the law. At least it is not yet necessary that they should do so. But when God will bring them to the mount, as he will here or hereafter, all these pretenses will vanish and disappear. Not one of them shall be able to suggest the least relief to a poor guilty sinner. His conscience shall be kept to that which he can neither abide nor avoid. Unless he can make the great plea of an interest in the blood of Christ, he is gone forever. And God gave herein a type and representation of the great judgment at the last day. The terror of it consists much in this, that sinners shall be able to see nothing but God in the tokens of his wrath. Nor does the law represent anything else to us. Number two, it was a barren and fruitless desert where there was neither water nor food. And answerable to this, the law in a state of sin would bring forth no fruit, nothing acceptable to God nor useful to the souls of men. For there was nothing on Sinai but bushes and brambles, whence it had its name. These made an appearance at a distance or some fruitfulness in the place, but when it came to be tried, there was nothing but what was fit for the fire. And so is it with all that are under the law. They may seem to perform many duties of obedience, yea, such as they may trust to and make their boast of, but when they are brought to the trial, they are no other but such as God speaks of in Isaiah 27, verse 4. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them, I would burn them together. Other fruit the law will not bring forth, nor was there any water in the desert of Horeb to make it fruitful. That which the people lived on was brought out of the rock, and that rock was Christ. From him alone are all refreshments to them that are under the law. Number three, no place in the habitable world has been ever since more desolate and forsaken, and such it continues to this day. And by this we are taught that although there was a necessity for the renovation of the law at that season, to give bounds to sin, yet that dispensation should not be continued, but be left forever as it is under the gospel, and that those who will abide under the law shall never have any token of God's presence with them, but shall be left to desolation and horror. God dwells no more on Sinai. Those who abide under the law shall neither have his presence nor any gracious pledge of it. And although things are spoken to stir us up to seek for an interest in that blessed gospel state which is here proposed to us, and thus much have we seen already that without it there is neither relief from the curse of the law, nor acceptable fruit of obedience, nor pledge of divine favor to be obtained. Number three, it manifests that the holiness of things and places is confined to their use, which when it ceases, they become common. What more holy place than Sinai during the presence of God on it? What now more desolate, forlorn, and despised? For although the superstition of latter ages has built a house or monastery on the top of this hill, for a mere superstitious devotion, yet God in his providence has sufficiently manifested his regardlessness of it and at casting it out of his care, and he denounces a sentence on this, on all that superstition and idolatry which in the Church of Rome, and their veneration of relics and pilgrimages to places of a supposed holiness, though utterly forsaken of all pledges of the divine presence. The second thing they came unto was a fire that burned, for so I rather read the words in the mount that burned with fire. For the fire was of itself a distinct token of God's presence, and a distinct means of filling the people with dread and fear. This fire is mentioned in Exodus 19, verse 18, the Lord descended on a mount in fire. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 12, the Lord spake out of the midst of the fire. It is said, indeed, that the mountain burned with fire, that is, fire burned on the mountain, and this fire had a double appearance. That which represented the descent of God on the mount, the Lord descended in fire. The people saw the token of God's presence in the descent of fire on the mount. And secondly, of the continuance of his presence there, for it continued burning all the while God spoke. He spake out of the fire. And it was a flaming fire which raised a smoke like the smoke of a furnace, Exodus 19, verse 18, which our apostle seems to express by blackness in the next word. Yea, this fire flamed and burned to the midst of heaven. Deuteronomy 4, verse 11. This fire was an emblem of the presence of God and of all the appearances on the mount. It was of the greatest terror to the people. And therefore, in their request to be freed from the dread of the presence of God, they three times mention this fire as the cause of their fear, Deuteronomy 5, verses 24 to 26. And God is often in the scripture represented by fire, Deuteronomy 4, verse 24, Isaiah 30, verse 33, Isaiah 33, verse 14, and his severity in the execution of his judgments is so called. And although here the light, purity, and holiness of the nature of God may also be represented by it, yet we shall confine it to the interpretation given of it in the scripture itself. First, as to God himself, it signifies his jealousy. So Moses expounds it in Deuteronomy 4, verse 24, for he closes his discourse with these words, "For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God." And the jealousy of God is his holy severity against sin, not to leave it unpunished. And with respect to the law which he then gave from his right hand when the fiery law for them, Deuteronomy 33, verse 2, it signified its inexorable severity and efficacy to destroy his transgressors. And we may add to this that it declared the terror of his majesty as a great legislator. So in the scripture, he is often said to be accompanied with fire, Psalms 18, verses 9 to 12, Psalm 1, verse 3. A fire shall devour before him, Psalm 97, 3, a fire goes before him, Daniel 7, 10, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. For there is nothing more apt to fill the hearts of men with a majestic awe than a fire absolutely prevalent above the power of all creatures. This is the first thing which the people beheld when they came to the mount. And when men under the law have to deal with God, their first apprehensions of him are his holiness and severity against sinners, with his anger and displeasure against sin. There the law leaves them, and thence they must be consumed without relief by Jesus Christ. These things are hid from sinners until they are brought to the law, or the law to them. They have no views, no notices of them in a due manner. So until the law comes, they are alive, that is, at peace and in security, well satisfied with their own condition. They don't see, they don't think of the fire that is ready to consume them. Yea, for the most part, they have quite other notions of God, Psalm 50, verse 21, or none at all. But this is the second work of the law, when it has by its convictions brought the sinner into a condition of a sense of guilt which he cannot avoid, nor will anything tender him relief which way soever he looks, for he is in a desert. It represents to him the holiness and severity of God with his indignation and wrath against sin, which have a resemblance of a consuming fire. This fills his heart with dread and terror and makes him see his miserable, undone condition, infinite holiness, inexorable justice, and fiery indignation are all in this representation of God. So the cry of those who find not the way of relief will one day be, who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire, who shall inhabit with those everlasting burnings. This is a way in progress of the work of the law on the consciences of sinners. First, when they are brought to it, it stops their mouths, makes them guilty before God or subject to his judgment, Romans 3:19. It shuts them all up in unbelief, Romans 11, verse 32. It concludes or shuts them up under sin, Galatians 3, verse 22. Gives them to see their lost condition without help, without relief. They are in a wilderness where is none but God and themselves. And secondly, in this condition they see the fire. God is represented to them. Therein is jealousy and severity against sin, which fills our hearts with dread and terror of this fire. It will consume them. If they continue to hear the voice out of the fire, they shall die. Somewhat of this, in some degree, is found in all on whom the law has its proper and effectual work, in order to the bringing of them to Christ, the deliverer. And all others shall find it in the highest degree when it will be too late to think of a remedy. To fire, the apostle adds blackness, as we render the word, whereto follow darkness and tempest. Before we speak to the words and things signified in particular, we must consider the consistency of the things that are spoken. For whereas fire is light in itself and gives light, how is it said that together with it there was blackness and darkness? Some distinguish at times and say there was an appearance of fire at first and afterwards of blackness and darkness. But this is directly contrary to the text, which frequently assigns the continuance of the fire to the end of God speaking to the people. Others would have respect to be had to several distinct parts of the mountain so as that the fire appeared in one part and darkness in another. But it is evident in the description given by Moses that they were mingled all together, for he affirms sometimes that God spake in and out of the fire, sometimes out of the thick darkness, Deuteronomy 5:22-24. The Lord spake to all of your assembly in the mount out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick darkness. Deuteronomy 5:22, the voice out of the midst of the thick darkness. 23, the voice out of the midst of the fire. 24, and the same is fully expressed in Deuteronomy 4:11-12. So that it is evident there was a mixture of them all together, and so it is described by David in Psalms 18:8-13. And nothing can be conceived of greater dread and terror than such a mixture of fire and darkness and tempest, which left nothing of light to the fire but its dread and terror. For by reason of this blackness and darkness, the people had no useful light by the fire. This filled them with confusion and perplexity. And this is a third thing in the progress of the work of the law on the consciences of sinners. When they are shut up under guilt and begin to be terrified with a representation of God's severity against sin, they cannot but look to see if there be anything in the manifestation of God and His will by the law that will yield them relief. But here they find all things covered with blackness or obscurity. The glory of God and His design in bringing them to the law or the law to them is hid and covered under the veil of this blackness. The design of God in this is not death, though the law in itself be the ministration of death, but He deals thus with them to drive them to Christ, to constrain them to flee for refuge to Him. But this design is to the law is covered with blackness. The sinner can see nothing of it, and so knows not how to order a speech towards God by reason of darkness. It is the gospel alone that reveals this design of God in the law. But instead of this, this blackness insinuates into the mind a dread of worse things that yet it can discern. When men see blackness in a cloud, they are apt to expect that thunder will break out of it every moment. So as it was sinners finding all things covered with blackness in the view that they would take of God by the law, it increases their dread and lets them into the things that follow. Therefore, observation 1, a view of God as a judge represented in fire and blackness will fill the souls of convinced sinners with dread and terror. How secure soever they may be at present, when God calls them forth to the mount, their hearts cannot endure, nor can their hands be strong. Under this blackness, the apostle adds darkness. Blackness is a property of a thing in itself. Darkness is its effect towards others. This blackness was such as with it caused darkness with respect to them to whom it was presented. So we may distinguish between the blackness and darkness of a thundercloud. It is black in itself and causes darkness to us. But this darkness is mentioned distinctly as a part of the appearance, Exodus 20:21. Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was in Deuteronomy 4:11. Darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. What this darkness was, we cannot well apprehend. But this it teaches us, that notwithstanding the revelation that God made of himself and the dispensation of the law he was as to his glory and the purposes of his grace and mercy, in thick darkness to the people, they could not see him nor discern him. Sinners can see nothing of it in or by the law. How this darkness was removed by the ministry of Christ and the gospel, how this cloud of darkness was scattered in the face of God as a Father, as a reconciled God, uncovered, revealed, and made known, is the subject of the writings of the New Testament. Hence the execution of the law is called blackness of darkness, Jude 1, verse 13. And to this the apostle adds the words, and tempest. And in this word he comprises the thunder, lightning, and earthquake that were then on and in the mount. This increased the terror of the darkness and made it a thick darkness as it is in Moses. As it was without in the giving of the law, so it is within in the work of the law. It fills the minds of men with a storm accompanied with darkness and perplexity. This is the issue that the law brings things to in the minds and consciences of sinners. It works ends in darkness and tempest. It has these two effects. First, it brings the soul into darkness that it knows not what to do, nor how to take one step towards its own relief. It can see no light, either for its direction or consolation. And on this, it either tires and wearies itself with vain endeavors for relief by its own works and duties, or else sinks into heartless despondencies and complaints, as is the manner of men in darkness. And secondly, it raises a tempest in the mind of disquieting, perplexing thoughts, oft-times accompanied with dread and terror. In this state, the law leaves poor sinners. It will not accompany them one step towards deliverance. It will neither reveal nor encourage them to look after any relief. Yea, it declares that here the sinner must die and perish for anything that the law knows or can do. This, therefore, is a place and season in which Christ interposes and cries to sinners, "Behold me, behold me." Now, though all these things tend to death, yet God was and God is exceedingly glorious in them. Yea, this is administration of them was so. The administration of death and condemnation was glorious, though it had no glory in this respect, by reason of the glory that excels, namely in the dispensation of the gospel, 2 Corinthians 3, verse 7. Howbeit in itself it did, and it does, manifest the glory of the holiness, justice, and severity of God, in which he will be glorified in that to eternity. These things, with all their dreadful effects, the apostle minds the Hebrews of their deliverance by Jesus Christ and his gospel to oblige them to constancy and perseverance in the profession of the faith, which we shall speak somewhat to afterwards.